In the beginning, Ibiza's ancient wells were sacred places of fertility, life and renewal, temples to the moon goddess Tanit. But slowly the people started forgetting, and the more they worshipped the god of the sun, the more the wells began to dry. You're listening to The Wells of Tanit, a podcast celebrating the folklore, mythology, history and ecology of the island of Ibiza. My name is Joanna Ruby. I'm an artist and puppeteer and the founder of Theatre of the Ancients, and we're about to journey together to one of Ibiza's wells to see what stories it has to tell us. Don't be afraid, take my hand, and let's go and find The Wells of Tanit. The cicadas are buzzing merrily. A day in midsummer on Ibiza has definitely begun. And here in this little clearing in the woods, I've got the cicadas on surround sound. I'm crouched down in the shade of some bushes and small trees, and there's some very green lush rosemary growing next to my feet. There's a very old dry stone wall hidden between the trees just beyond me that seems like it's virtually incorporated itself into the curves of the land. And about a metre away from where I am, there is a stone carved vessel on the ground. A beautiful organic shape carved out in the centre. This, of course, tells us that we are beside a well, as so many of these local Ibizan wells have these stone vessels beside them, so that when country people arrived to them in the past, they could immediately give their animals some water to drink. There's a lovely, gentle breeze arriving into this little clearing in the woods, offering much relief on this day in early July. And now I'm going to stand up and walk towards a structure. A rectangular opening made out of huge, dark-coloured pieces of stone. And there is an entrance, and there are stone steps going down. And now I'm faced with a stone entranceway going underground. On either side are high stone walls whose surfaces have darkened with time and with mosses and lichen. And there are green little plants pushing their way up in tiny gaps along this stone staircase, which I'm now beginning to walk down. And the rays of the midsummer sun are shining right into this tunnel. We'll come back to that theme a little bit later. Down here, the chamber of the well opens up into a gorgeous oval arch. There's a happy collection of flies buzzing around down here. Down here in the inner chamber, the walls are smoother and they've got traces of white plaster. And on my left now, I'm seeing the faint traces of decorative lines painted on the pale plaster in a red colour, which might be the red manganese oxide, which was often used as a pigment to decorate these local sites. And I'm entering the domain of the flies, taking some further steps down. Here they're really hanging out. And the reason why is because it's lovely down here. It's gone down several degrees cooler. The sun's rays struggle to reach this far down. And here, in the centre, there is a pool of water which almost reaches the height of the bottom step of the well. The flies are loving the water being splashed. And I'm actually going to get out because this is becoming a bit of an Indiana Jones film. Ooh, from the chorus of the flies back to the chorus of the cicadas. I'm going to go back to my little shady spot where the ground is covered with very pressed old moss. And I'm going to say hello. So, on this midsummer day in early July, I find myself at the Font den Prats near Atzarel in the central north of Ibiza. As far as I'm aware, this is a very well-known, valued and loved well by many local people. But it seems so far that only one person has ever come up with an explanation for those geometric line decorations inside the chamber. And as I said, I'll come back to that later on. So, in the Guía Mágica de Fuentes y Pozos de Santa Eulalia del Río, or The Magical Guide to Wells and Springs of Santa Eulalia, published over 30 years ago by Michel Ferrer Clapés, the writer observes, "This is an extremely interesting and original well. Inside, it conserves some ornamental paintings whose age is unknown and which merit a full investigation and adequate protection." Then the writer adds, "On our last visit in December 1994, we observed with huge sadness and indignation that vandals had graffitied over the ancient paintings inside the chamber on one side." Well, today, over 30 years later, there are definitely no traces of the graffiti, but hardly any traces of the original paintings either. So, something so special about the Font den Prats is that it's a well which you can only really find if somebody takes you there. So the first route is to follow a virtually invisible track that leads into the woods, then take a little detour and you find yourself almost on your hands and knees rummaging through the undergrowth as the path curves down into a dip. It's really like going into the underworld, and when you come out to the well on the other side, it feels like you've undergone a huge epic challenge. The other way to arrive here is a track that goes beside a dry stone wall with a huge pine tree beyond it. And a lovely detail about this track, this old road surrounded by dry stone walls, is that it's very much abandoned. You can tell because it's filled with pine needles up to knee height. The path then leads beside a mossy, abandoned threshing floor, and it weaves behind the most incredible whitewashed farmhouse, which is absolutely frozen in time. Visible from this rear track is the cobbled courtyard behind the house. Modestly decorated, nothing much more than a chicken house. And in previous years, I would sometimes see the paisa woman, the inhabitant of this house, going out to feed her chickens. An elderly lady, I remember her being dressed in black, wearing a headscarf. It was like a scene from a century ago. She is the custodian of this well. It's on her land. But the last times that I've come here, I've not seen her anymore. So, it's early July 2026. And the heat waves are rippling again and again across much of Europe, and I guess we can still keep calling them heat waves, or maybe we could just start calling them the new summer in an era of undeniable climate change. But over the past winter, exceptionally heavy rains, which were linked, according to many, by shifting weather patterns caused by climate change, filled the local wells to record new levels, and the same is absolutely the case for the Font den Prats, which I found now in high summer, and it's full of water. Amazing. But it remains to be seen how much longer these wells will hold water as summer and the tourist season really take hold. So not so long ago was the summer solstice, or here, the Nit de San Juan, St. John's Night, the midsummer festival of these lands of Spain, which here has always traditionally been marked by the jumping of bonfires, especially in the Ibizan village of the same name, San Juan de la Bricha. But over on the other side of the island, down in the south, there was another nocturnal midsummer celebration, which perhaps went even deeper into the spirit of St. John's Night, the night when the past is burnt away and a new cycle is commemorated. Like every year, there was the gathering organised by the Institut d'Estudis Ibicencs, the Institute of Ibizan Studies, a society dedicated to the preservation of Ibizan culture and heritage. And in keeping with tradition, this involved them reading out a late-night manifesto in, of course, Ibiza's local Catalan dialect of Ibicenc. Let me share a little extract for you. For years, the Institut d'Estudis Ibicencs has been warning that the uncontrolled growth that we're experiencing as an island is completely unsustainable and not the right path forward. Now we are facing the consequences. The housing crisis, water shortages, loss of biodiversity, a sense of rootlessness and a lack of identity, the saturation of nearly all public services, such as healthcare, amongst others, traffic problems, landscape degradation, rising crime, the privatisation of stretches of coastline and sea, illegal parties that deny residents their rest, and the list goes on. Ibiza and Formentera have become a teat that everybody wishes to milk for all that it's worth. Wonderful line. Our Catalan language is also under attack by those who ought to defend it, and our historical, ecological and cultural heritage is suffering from the neglect of those who ought to champion it. Take the Ibizan lizard, for example, now nearly extinct due to the passivity of our institutions. So this feisty midnight manifesto, recited in the twilight hours in Ibiza's local Catalan dialect of Ibicenc, seems like a perfect segue into the subject at the heart of this episode. Llengua, or language. What is this mysterious but intrinsic connection, as illustrated so clearly in the Institut d'Estudis Ibicencs Midsummer Manifesto, between language, territory, tradition and cultural identity? What does Catalan or Ibicenc mean to the people on Ibiza who insist on speaking it, despite all of the forces which try to prevent them from doing it? Why do they insist? What happens to a territory when its native language is invaded and overpowered by other, more powerful languages? For example, English. And what do we, the English speakers, miss out on when we don't learn the mother tongue, the llengua, of the land that we're in? So in order to shed some light on this subject, I'm going to be making some detours into the indigenous language of another land, the British Isles. My own homeland, where, beneath the firm stronghold of the English language, we find traces of another indigenous language which is 1,000 years older. Gaelic. Accompanying this meandering journey will be the sounds of the Irish group Clannad, which early on in its trajectory made the controversial choice to adopt the Gaelic language into their music. Band member Moya Brennan recalled in an interview once, "When we first performed songs in Gaelic, people would turn their backs. They regarded it as a poor man's language. It was like we were letting them down. But the thing is, we'd fallen in love with the Gaelic melodies." Clannad went on to achieve international acclaim, bringing the Gaelic language into households across Europe and the world. Meanwhile, in his book Soil and Soul, Alistair McIntosh recalls growing up on the tiny Scottish island of Lewis in the Outer Hebrides, with one foot firmly rooted in the Scottish Gaelic language as he witnessed globalisation sweep English across the terrain. On remembering the spirit and the feeling of a culture that was rooted in Gaelic, the author recalled that a deep respect for one another and an intense reverence for nature are woven into the language of many Gaelic speakers. Concepts like blessing, fate, and fortune are innate. When people said, "God bless you," they meant something that shouldn't be dismissed as superstition or treated as a simple "have a nice day." Something that Alistair McIntosh described as indigenous green consciousness was contained in Scottish and Irish Gaelic literature. It was a kind of animism. Nature was filled with spirit. McIntosh described it as a shamanistic culture, a confluence of community and nature. But then the author described the arrival of the English language to this traditional insular Scottish community when he was a schoolboy. He says, "Only three of us in a class of 19 spoke English. I can remember teachers saying that Gaelic is important, but to get on in the world, everybody should learn English." Much of the rest of the book is devoted to the author's attempts to reclaim the Gaelic culture and poetic mindset that was gradually stripped from his community as Gaelic became replaced by English. At one point, he quotes a simple but earth-shattering Scottish Gaelic expression: "He who loses his language loses his world." So here, back on Ibiza, the linguistic layers of this land are maybe even more complex. Since Catalan invaders overthrew the Moors in 1235, Catalan has been the official language of Ibiza. Each of the Balearic Islands has their own dialect of Catalan, and on Ibiza it's Ibisenc. Many common surnames on the island, like Marie, Tour, Torres, Ribas, Cardona, originate from medieval Catalan of the 13th century. Then, fast-forwarding to the 20th century, during the terrible Franco regime from 1939 to 1975, Catalan was completely repressed, prohibited, and replaced by Spanish, as with what happened to Basque and other minority languages of Spain. In 1983, after the death of Franco, the Balearic Islands became an autonomous community and Ibiza returned to being a Catalan-speaking territory. And since then, there's been a huge push for it to be taught in schools, used in public institutions, and integrated into society as much as possible. However, at the same time, Spanish remains a co-official language on Ibiza, based on Ibiza also being ruled by Spain's central government in Madrid. And today, as we will find out, it seems that there are messy and complicated power dynamics between these two supposedly co-official languages. Meanwhile, rapidly expanding mass tourism, globalisation and gentrification on Ibiza mean that entire subcultures and communities of expat residents operate in English. A recent study found that Catalan is spoken by only 23.9% of Ibiza's residents, significantly less than on all of the other Balearic Islands. Less than 3 out of 10 residents say that they identify with the language. Reflecting on these statistics, the Institute of Ibizan Studies commented, "Our language is receding due to our own negligence, as well as a lack of self-esteem and collective dignity." So I guess the only place we can go from there is back here, beside a rural well on Ibiza, where an English person is recording a podcast in the English language. So I wanted to cross over the barrier to the other side. I wanted to get the perspective of somebody rooted firmly in the island's native Catalan and Ibisenc language, to try to understand what this language feels like and what it means, and what it feels like to witness it being devalued and overlooked, and finally, why it's worth fighting for. So, you're about to hear an interview that I did a while ago with a woman that I admire hugely, the Ivesenkan poet, writer, performance maker and activist Jessica Ferrer-Escandey. So, she was happy to share her time and thoughts with me on one tiny condition, that the interview would happen in Catalan. I think that you'll understand why when you've listened to it. It goes without saying that it was my most challenging beginner's level Catalan language experience yet. The voiceover for Jessica has been kindly provided by Olivia Gajetsky.
So, al camp profund entre Sant Llorenç de Balàfia i Santa Gertrudis, i estic al costat d'un pou molt especial.
I'm deep in the countryside, somewhere between San Lorenzo and Santa Gertrudis, and I'm beside a very special well.
Tinc l'honor d'estar al costat del pou familiar de Jessica Ferrer-Escandey.
It's an honor to be sat next to the family well of Jessica Ferrer-Escandey.
Hola, Jessica.
Hola, Joana. Moltes gràcies per aquesta invitació, participar en aquesta conversa.
Hello, Joana. Many thanks for your invitation to be part of this conversation.
No. Moltíssimes gràcies a tu, Jessica. Com va?
No. Thanks to you, Jessica. How's it going?
Molt bé. Està molt bé per aquí.
Very good. Here we are, enjoying this lovely breeze.
Fa sol, hi ha taronges i... Sí, maravillosa. A veure.
Yep, the sun is shining, we've got orange trees next to us, it's all very lovely. So, first of all, just to say that I'm doing something a little bit crazy here. This is my first ever interview in Catalan.
Agraeixo sincerament a la meva entrevistada.
I sincerely appreciate the patience and tolerance of my interviewee. Thank you so much, Jessica.
Enhorabona per aquest desafiament, també, perquè no és fàcil, i estic molt contenta de ser, a més, la teua acompanyant d'aquesta primera entrevista en català.
Congratulations for taking on this challenge, because it's not easy, and I'm very happy to accompany you for this first interview in català.
Que bé, super. Començarem. A veure, una petita introducció a Jessica.
Great, super, let's do this. So, first of all, a little introduction to Jessica. Jessica Ferrer-Escandey is a poet, writer, and performance maker who was born and raised in San Lorenzo, Ibiza. She studied Catalan philology at the University of Barcelona, and in 2017 she relocated to Brazil, where she spent 4 years lecturing in Catalan language, culture and literature at the University of São Paulo. Since she returned to Ibiza in 2020, she's published several poetry books, one of which, called Som Aquí, received the Francesc Garigael Poetry Prize in 2022, and she forms one half of the performance collective Ses Honorables Virtuts Illogicas, which translates as The Honorable Illogical Virtues, in which she performs alongside the Uruguayan clown and musician Diego Martínez.
Jessica es una de las fundadores de la revista 078.
Jessica is also one of the founders of Revista 078, or 078 Magazine, a new independent Ibizan publishing collective which aims to promote dialogue and reflection about the Ibizas that we know and the Ibizas we are yet to know.
Bé, Jessica, som aquí per parlar d'un tema que crec que tots dos tenim molt present.
So, Jessica, we're here to talk about a subject which I think is pretty important to both of us, the connection between language and cultural identity on Ibiza, and what happens to a place when it becomes colonised by the English language due to tourism and globalisation.
Però aquest és un tema amb múltiples capes, així que comencem pel principi.
But this is a theme with many different layers to it, so let's start at the beginning. Jessica, we could say that you're a San Lorenzo girl. How did your childhood in rural Ibiza shape your understanding of the island's cultural identity? And what part did the Catalan language, or Ibiza's local dialect of Ivesenc, play in that?
Sí, jo venc d'una família que passa les dues bandes, és una família pagesa ibicenca.
Both sides of my family are, you could say, pagès, or typical Ibizan country people. It's also true that my parents are from a particular class of pagés, which typically also had a flat in Ibiza town and would spend Monday to Friday in Ibiza town, and then at the weekend they would go up to their home in San Miguel, or San Lorenzo in my case, to be in the countryside, to be around my grandparents, to work on the land, and all of that.
Crec que a la meva generació hi ha moltes persones amb aquesta com doble vida, mig d'escamp, mig de vila.
So I think my parents were like many other local people who live a kind of double life, half in the country and half in the city. In the city they're seen as country people, and in the country they're seen as city folk. Anyway, my family is Catalan speaking, and it's the first language that I've ever learned. But the thing is, on Ibiza, like practically in all other Catalan territories, you grow up speaking Catalan, but you also learn Spanish. And the idea is that these two languages coexist and share a territory together. Catalan is the language we grew up with, but there is also the presence of Spanish. When we turn on the television out on the streets in school, it's like you grew up with this bilingualism, but then later in life you realize, oh, actually, this isn't bilingualism, it's something else. It's a disglosia, which means that there's an inequality and each language is used in very different situations and environments.
És com que tu saps que el català té uns àmbits durs, que són la teva família i certes persones, però la gent o que no coneixes o que ve de fora.
It's like you realize that you speak Catalan with your family, with people you know well, but people who you don't know so well or who come from somewhere else, or they're the children of people who came from somewhere else, you realize that you need to speak in Spanish. And then after that comes the theme of English. In my case, as I went to school in Ibiza town, pretty much everyone at my school was either Ibizan or the children of migrants who had come to Ibiza from mainland Spain, so therefore they spoke Spanish. Or they were children of people from more distant parts of the world. Morocco, Ecuador, Colombia. So generally, most of these kids could speak Spanish, Catalan, and in a lot of cases, Arabic.
I sí que sabia que la gent que estudiava, no sé, a l'Institut de Sant Llorenç, que hi havia alguns fills d'estrangers que també parlaven anglès.
And yeah, I did know people who went to school at the secondary school at San Lorenzo, for example, who had English speakers in their classes, who were the children of foreign parents. And yeah, these kids spoke English, but were also pretty integrated with the locals. The impression that I had growing up was that English was somehow the language that we had to learn in order to be able to earn a good living sometime in the future. Since I was little, my parents paid for me to have English classes in a local academy. Because one day, when you're older and you need to find work, obviously that work will be in tourism.
La teva condició social via feina vinculada al turisme. No era ni sa llengua en aquella època que hauria de parlar amb vecins d'Eivissa.
So I had to master English. And for me, English was always linked to this aspiration to improve your social position by getting work in the tourism industry. In those days, English wasn't the language you spoke with the people around you, with your neighbors, and it wasn't really a language that helped you to travel or study abroad either. It was a language specifically related to work, and to work in tourism.
I clar, durant el franquisme, el català i altres llengües minoritàries van ser censurades i substituïdes per castellà.
So, during the Franco era, Catalan and other marginalized languages were censored and replaced by Spanish. Today, technically, the island has two official languages. How is this tension between Spanish and Catalan today for you and your family?
És molt interessant perquè, d'alguna manera, en els últims, podem dir, 60 anys, s'ha invertit la situació.
It's really interesting because over the past 50 or 60 years, you could say, the situation has completely flipped around. During the Franco dictatorship, the majority of the island was absolutely Catalan-speaking. The language that people communicated with each other in, the one you heard all around the island, was Catalan. But meanwhile, in schools and other formal settings, the only permitted language was Spanish. Spanish was the language of power, you could say. And it was also the language of social prestige. If you had an education, you could speak Spanish. So for example, people like my parents, they are 100% Catalan speakers, but they only read and write in Spanish because it's the language they were taught at school. After they left school, they never studied any further. And so they never learned how to write the language that they actually speak. And there's a whole generation like that.
Amb seus anys, no, com que amb tot el boom turístic va venir com moltes persones, no, mà d'obra treballadora d'altres zones d'Espanya que eren castellanoparlants.
When the tourism boom arrived and there was this whole influx of manual workers from mainland Spain, who of course were Spanish speakers, they came to Ibiza and soon the demographics of Ibiza began to change. Now, I don't know the population of the island, but it's grown enormously. And now we find ourselves in the opposite situation to before. Today, out in the streets, the language that you hear most is Spanish. I guess I'm referring to places like Ibiza Town, because we haven't arrived yet to the subject of English-speaking circles. We'll get there in a moment. But now, the most common language is Spanish. For example, if you go to a school playground, it's most likely the kids will be speaking in Spanish. But if you go into the school classrooms and also the local institutions and government buildings, there everyone speaks in Catalan. So the situation has completely flipped around. And it's a little bit sad, to be honest, because you would think that with the dawning of a new democracy, there could be a balance between the language the local people had always spoken and the language that's in power. But that balance is currently non-existent.
Parlem una mica més sobre el món de l'anglès a Ibiza. A veure.
Let's talk a little bit more about the world of English speakers on Ibiza. In your youth, did you know the other Ibiza, the globalized Ibiza, which also inhabited your island and which operated largely in English? And how did it feel to live on an island which also hosted that parallel reality?
Clar, jo, o sigui, fins que no vaig tornar a Ibiza fa 5 anys, jo desconeixia un poc aquesta Ibiza. És a dir, a Ibiza no són dos Ibiza, són 4.000 Ibizas.
Yeah. Until I returned to Ibiza 5 years ago, I didn't really know that. That's Ibiza. I mean, Ibiza isn't really two Ibizas. It's 4,000 Ibizas. And the globalized Ibiza that I knew was the one caused by immigration from the global south, which is mostly visible in the urban centers. So, for example, my secondary school was very globalized, but it was globalized by people from mostly Latin America, Asia, and Morocco. But this other Ibiza that you're talking about, I think that one has been expanding in more recent years, and it's mostly found in the rural areas of the island. So in urban centers like Ibiza Town and in San Antonio, where it's mostly working class people, they stay on the margins. But on the other hand, in these rural areas, in the villages where actually you would imagine the inhabitants are mostly elderly or traditional people, you think, oh, wow, we are coexisting with some people around here who are not elderly and not very traditional either.
I clar, a mi em va sorprendre molt perquè, sobretot, jo què sé, ho veig molt amb les matrícules dels cotxes, per exemple.
And yeah, it surprised me a lot, especially with the number plates on the cars. I mean, in the summer it's normal to see number plates from different foreign countries, but when it's February and half of the cars you see parked in the middle of nowhere in the countryside have foreign number plates, you think, I guess these people live here all year round. So, yeah. I began to realize that this other Ibiza existed and was growing more and more.
I em va sorprendre molt, sobretot perquè crec que la novetat és que són comunitats bastant autosuficients socialment.
And above all, I guess what surprised me most was this new aspect, that this other Ibiza is basically a socially self-sufficient community. In fact, it seems like a lot of these people don't actually feel the need and have little interest in learning Spanish. Let alone Catalan, because they don't need it. And they are totally disinterested in connecting with the local population. And I feel like this attitude is, quite harmful.
Ara mateix crec que fas tota la teva feina artística a Catalan, avui en dia.
These days, if I'm correct, you carry out all of your artistic work in Catalan.
Exactament, sí. És a dir, jo continuo sent una activista lingüística. Sí que és la meva manera de ser una activista per la llengua catalana és, evidentment, utilitzar la llengua catalana en tot el que faig.
Exactly, yes. I'm trying to be a linguistic activist. My way to be an activist with the Catalan language is to use it in everything that I do. First of all, because I see it as my own language, the language of the territory that I inhabit. And also because I feel the use of Catalan really needs to be promoted, and I want to do all that I can to do that. More and more, I'm focusing my energy on the area of literature. which I guess is my specialism, my chosen artistic practice.
Clar, l'espanyol té, crec que vaig buscar-ho, uns 600 o 650 milions de parlants.
I think I read somewhere that Spanish literature has an audience of about 600 million people, whereas I think Catalan, according to the most optimistic estimates, has an audience of about 7 or 8 million. And I guess that a lot of people would choose to aim for the biggest audience possible. You would think that would be the most logical thing to do, to write for that audience. So, yeah, I didn't choose that option.
Jo, òbviament, no vaig optar per aquest cas. Vaig optar per òbviament, per fer-ho en català, de la manera que per jo té més sentit.
I chose to write for a Catalan audience, not because I wanted to destroy my chances of reaching a large audience, but because I feel like, actually, by purposefully focusing on a smaller, more concentrated audience, your work can actually have a bigger impact. You might be aiming for a smaller audience, but it's a more committed audience. So, yeah, my choice is not to limit my work, but actually to increase the receptivity to my work.
Crec que has dit que menys pot ser més.
I think you use the phrase less can be more.
Exactament, exactament.
Yeah, exactly.
Una frase que també a mi m'agrada moltíssim.
It's a phrase that I am also a big fan of.
Sí, sí, sí. I també al final, és, no sé, som menys persones, per tant, tenim espai per estar atentes al que fa aquesta comunitat, no?
Yeah. And in the end, it's like you're speaking to less people, but there's more space, more possibility for attentiveness and more chance to create real community.
Has dit que el colonialisme lingüístic de l'anglès és el centre de molts dels problemes moderns de la IA.
You previously said that the theme of linguistic colonialism of the English language lies at the heart of many of Abitha's modern problems, including ecological problems such as the water crisis. What do you see as the connection between language, social injustice and environmental issues on Abitha?
A veure, crec que tot es podria resumir amb els conceptes d'imperialisme, colonialisme.
Let's see. I think it can be summed up within the framework of imperialism and colonialism. In the end, it's about the capacity of certain societies with a greater acquisitive power to alter or transform other territories which are less economically powerful. So this has to do with ownership of land and property, it has to do with cultural products, and it has to do with language.
Al final, la relació va per aquí, no? Va per aquesta... aquesta capacitat que dona la riquesa econòmica per imposar la seva manera de fer les coses.
So, it's about that. It's about this capacity created by economic wealth, which puts one society in a position where they can impose their way of doing things in an economical, cultural and linguistic sense on another society. And in the case of Ibiza, it happens mostly with English. But in another territory, for example, in Latin America, it would be with Spanish. There, Spanish is the imperialistic language which has colonized an entire continent. So I think that's what I'm talking about.
Hi ha una frase que em parla molt. La llengua configura la percepció. Per a mi, el procés d'aprendre el català ha estat una mica màgic en molts sentits.
There's a phrase that speaks to me a lot. Language shapes perception. For me, the process of learning Catalan has been a little bit magical in various ways. When you overcome the complete embarrassment, the humiliation, the difficulty, you find yourself undergoing a kind of a small transformation, entering into a new, deeper relationship with the island and its people in strange, subtle ways. Which perceptions of Abitha do you think can be gained by speaking the Catalan language and the local dialect of Ibicenc?
Clar, la llengua és territori, no? Les paraules que existeixen a Eivissa per dir com es diuen els llocs, com es diuen, jo no sé, les formes geogràfiques, com es diuen els objectes, com es diuen les pràctiques domèstiques, els menjars, són paraules en català.
Well, language is territory. The words that exist on Ibiza to say, for example, place names, geographical locations, physical objects, domestic practices, different types of food, these are all Catalan words. So if you don't speak Catalan, you can encounter these things but not fully understand them or connect with them. For me, it's about that. You can't deeply connect with Ibiza without speaking or knowing Catalan. And of course, you can live on Ibiza without deeply connecting with it, as many people do, but I think that that is a loss.
Clar, també és veritat que hi ha moltes persones que, per qüestions laborals i econòmiques, perquè estan en una situació super precaritzada...
And at the same time, there are many people who, due to their precarious economic or work situation, don't have the time or the resources to learn the language, because there is no underestimating it. It's a big thing to learn a new language. But on the other hand, I think there are lots of people who do have the resources to learn, but they don't. And that's a shame. It's also true that now, compared with, say, 20 years ago, it's very easy for you as a foreigner, in this case as an English speaker, to create a social network around you that is 100% English speaking, so that you literally feel like you have no need to learn the local language, because you've got all your friends around you, you've got your local places that you hang out in, which are English speaking. So you just don't have the need. And I do think this is one of the island's problems, you know. Why is it so easy to live on Ibiza and for there to be such disconnection?
A veure, l'eslògan principal de la revista 078, el col·lectiu editorial en català que vas cofundar, és les Ibizas que són i les que podrien ser. Quines creus que són les Ibizas que podrien ser?
The slogan of your project, Revista 078, or 078 magazine, is the Ibizas that we know and the Ibizas we are yet to know. Which do you think are the Ibizas that we are yet to know?
No ho sé, les estem descobrint, no? Justament vàrem fer com aquest eslògan perquè creiem que defineix molt la nostra filosofia, no?
I don't know. We are still finding them. We came up with that slogan because we really felt that it summed up our philosophy. On the one hand, the Ibizas that we know are all the different ways that people already inhabit this island, the ones which we are already familiar with. And then there are the Ibizas which we are yet to discover. Well, we don't know what they are, but our ethos is to allow ourselves to imagine them. To allow ourselves to design another different island. To imagine how things could be.
Crec que una cosa que mos està passant molt en aquest present és que tenim un context global que és atroç.
Because I think something that is happening a lot in our present times, as we live within a global context that is just atrocious, terrible. You know, we read the news and everything is just so, so messed up on so many levels. But at the same time, we need to harness the attitude that things can change, that things could be different. So, we're trying to create a space of hope and imagination. You know, as long as we are able to simply imagine a more habitable planet or island, that counts for a lot.
I pot ser que vols dir que la illa tingui su veu propi, algo així.
And are you saying somehow that it's important for the island to cultivate its own voice?
Sí, clar, també una cosa que mos passava és veritat, o sigui, a Ibiza és un territori que...
Yeah, this is another theme on this island. You see, Ibiza is the kind of place that if you look for literature, for example, about the island, the majority that you'll find was written by non-Ibizans, by people who arrived to the island from somewhere else and discovered the island, and then through their writing, introduced it to the rest of the world. Ibiza, of course, has its own literary legacy and tradition. For example, the poet Maria Bian Gómez, one of the island's best-known literary references, and there are several others. People have written about Ibiza from an Ibizan perspective. Okay, there's not so many of them, but I guess in general we do feel the lack of a voice which speaks about ourselves, to ourselves.
I volíem com anar-lo a buscar, i sabem que és això, que és un relat que és múltiple, per això ses Ibizas que són.
And we strongly feel that this voice needs multiple threads to it. For that reason, we talk about the Ibizas, we know, in plural. Because the story I would want to share about Ibiza is different from the one from my friend who is the child of immigrants who migrated to Ibiza from Murcia. And their story is just as valid as mine. So those are stories I really want to listen to, because also, as pretty much all of the cultural products that we consume here come from elsewhere, whether that be Madrid or Hollywood or wherever, we really lack that understanding of who we are. We don't really know who we are. And of course we aren't just one thing, but we want to play and experiment and question what we might be.
Jessica, crec que estem arribant al final d'aquesta conversació tan interessant. Doncs la meva última pregunta serà, com es pot trobar I donar suport a la teva feina?
Jessica, I think we're beginning to arrive to the end of this conversation, which has been so, so interesting. My final question for you is, how can people find and support your work?
Bé, a veure, podeu comprar els meus llibres, que això és una manera. Podeu convèncer també gent que programi a diferents ajuntaments d'Eivissa que contractin algun espectacle meu.
Right. Well, you could go and buy some of my books, which is always great. You could also help to persuade the people who program performances in the cultural institutions of Eivissa to book in one of my performances. But above all, the easiest way would be to support 078 magazine. So you can head to our website at revista078.xyz, and there's a section where you can sign up as a member, paying a minimum annual donation of 30 euros, which will help us to continue with this collective project. A project which actually feels more important than any of our personal projects.
Super, super. Bé, des del pou de la casa familiar de Jessica. Moltíssimes, moltíssimes gràcies, Jessica, per compartir el teu temps I molta sort amb tot I anirem parlant.
Wonderful. So, from the family well at Jessica's house, all I can say is thank you so, so much, Jessica, for giving me your time and the best of luck with everything you do. Bye for now.
Sí, moltes gràcies I res, seguim aquí construint idees col·lectivament.
Thanks back to you and let's carry on creating and co-creating.
Shortly after this interview was recorded, Jessica and the other founding members of Revista 78, or 078 magazine, received an award for their work. And in their acceptance speech, they gave thanks for, in their words, recognizing this project, which challenges the notion that high-quality, vigorous culture can only be created off the island of Ibiza, and which combats an artistic and cultural landscape on Ibiza, which is extractive, which appropriates the value of Ibiza and its identity without giving anything back. So let's go a little bit deeper into some of the theory behind the viewpoints expressed so strongly and eloquently by Jessica. In 2008, the then English Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, declared about the English language, "English is the pathway of global communication and global access to knowledge, the vehicle for hundreds of millions of people on all countries to connect with each other, a bridge across borders and cultures, and a source of unity in a rapidly changing world." Without any further delay, let's go and visit the dark side of this sweeping, unifying movement of the English language around the world as expressed by Gordon Brown. It's time for a little introduction to the term linguistic imperialism, coined by the research professor Robert Philipson. He says, "Linguistic imperialism is a form of linguicism which benefits and grants power to the dominating or oppressing language and its speakers." Philipson set out some defining characteristics of linguistic imperialism in action. These included a favouring of the dominant language over another along similar lines as racism and sexism, more resources and infrastructure given to the dominant language, encouraging beliefs that the dominant language is more prestigious than others, being intertwined with the same oppressive structures in culture, education, media, and politics, and having an exploitative essence which causes injustice and inequality between those who use the dominant language and those who do not. Can you think of any English-speaking enterprises, projects, or services on Ibiza which fulfill these criteria? I personally can think of a few, but I'll leave them to your imagination. Anyway, we've heard a local insider's perspective about Ibiza's native language, and now we're going to flip things around and listen to an individual who started as an outsider over 40 years ago, and then did what not so many foreigners have done before, and ventured right into the centre. British-born Hazel Morgan is the president of Amics de la Terra Ibiza, Friends of the Earth Ibiza. But what's more, she's a fluent Catalan and Ibisenc speaker who generally gets passed off as an Ibisenca most of the time. A while back, I ventured over to her house near Santa Eulalia to see whether it's more than just a coincidence that someone so passionate about protecting Ibiza's landscapes is also so passionate about protecting Ibiza's native language.
So here I am on the edge of Canguash, on the edge of Santa Eulalia, and I am at the house of Hazel Morgan. Now, Hazel Morgan is the president of Amics de la Terra, or Friends of the Earth. She is a highly respected environmental and social campaigner on Ibiza, not just with Amics de la Terra, but also with other groups such as Cambiem el Rumb, which over the past couple of years has been campaigning for Ibiza's government to place limits on tourism for the sake of environmental, social and cultural well-being. And Hazel first came to Ibiza in 1972, and according to an interview that I read this morning, from that moment onwards she decided that Ibiza was the place she would like to spend the rest of her life. And from that same interview this morning, I read that the interview took place at Ses Feixes, at Hazel's request, which is a historical piece of wetland on the edge of Ibiza town, which in the Moorish era was an immense irrigated vegetable garden, I guess you could call it, of a kind that is apparently unique to the world, but in present times has become an abandoned wasteland. And on discussing Hazel's reason for wanting the interview to take place there, according to the interview, Hazel stated, because it's a symbol of what could be a botanical natural paradise, an emblem of sustainable tourism, if only our politicians were a little more intelligent.
Makes me.
And I just wanted to say good morning, by the way, Hazel.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with me. And I just wanted to point out to listeners that you were quite moved to hear those words that I said.
Yes.
Why were you moved by them?
Gosh, well, I think talking about Ibiza and its future is always a bit worrying. So I moved again thinking about it, yeah. I'm thinking about the future for all the people who are going to be living here, my grandchildren and other peoples and the future population. It's not going well, so.
Well, there's many layers of this conversation that we're going to move through, and I think an idea underlying this is that the situation on Ibiza is related to so many different areas, isn't it? The cultural, the social, the environmental.
Yes, yes, definitely.
And you're so deeply involved on an environmental level, but I suppose maybe we could rewind the story a little bit, because as you know, the reason why I wanted to talk to you this morning isn't overtly related to ecological reasons. It's actually something deeper, perhaps, which is the simple fact, Hazel, that you're one of the few people that I know on Ibiza who is a native English person who I am more accustomed to hear speaking fluent Catalan or even Ibisenc. And I guess I feel that maybe the subject of language and ecology and the well-being of the island are all very, very interlinked.
They are linked. I mean, first of all, when I came to Ibiza, I didn't know that Catalan, or a local language, even existed, actually. It wasn't clear to me at all. And so for the first few years, I was very busy with my children and earning money and things that people need to do. And then I began to realise that there was. In fact, some of the words I'd learnt thinking they were Spanish were actually local Ibicencos. But there was no promotion of it at all. So when the government changed and the Consell Insular went from right-wing parties to left-wing, they offered courses in Catalan for foreigners, and so I signed up for that. At the same time, I was also getting involved in Friends of the Earth here and mixing with a lot more local people, and I thought this is a good opportunity to start to get into what is the local language, which of course not just forms part of the culture, but is the identity. Language is so important as the identity of the people who speak it, which is one of the reasons I think why, well, for sure, that the right wing then boycott it, try to squash it, eliminate its use, because if you can control the identity of a people, then you can do a lot more of what you want to do. So, yes, identity. And
Identity goes so deeply, doesn't it? And language is identity, is one of the many things. You begin to discover when you learn the language that a whole world opens. You discover a new world. You begin to understand the people, why things are done the way they're done. And so the things closest to people's heart have special words. And so in that way, I began to discover what a wonderful thing it was, and people appreciated it. The local people didn't make fun of me because I made lots of mistakes. And to tell the truth, at the beginning, it's humbling. You have to be prepared to make mistakes, which is a barrier to a lot of people. You have to be prepared to sound childish and not knowing what you're talking about, and that's hard. That's the hardest part, I think. But when you start and people encourage you, well, you have to get over that, and it's a good thing to be humbled, isn't it, I think? So I think that definitely language is so important to understand the way people are. I didn't come to Ibiza for sun and sea or cheap booze, you know. Because of the people, because of the landscape, because of the feeling that Ibiza has.
What feeling did Ibiza have when you arrived in that time?
Well, it was strange, really, because it felt like home. When I came the first time, I was with my husband and his child too. And so we explored a lot all over the island and fell in love with the architecture and the landscapes and the dry stone walls and all these wonderful things that have involved so much work and passion and dedication throughout centuries, and have a good function, have an important function. So the combination of the art and the skill of the people and the dedication is also, it's impressive. So all of this, somehow or other, the feeling of feeling home was not something I can explain, really. It just felt right.
And did you feel, as you began your relationship with the island, that it had sort of certain layers to it, and that the language, for example, was and aspects of those layers?
No, at the beginning, I like many, many people who come here and who don't know that Catalan is the local language, I felt quite indignant that there was a confusion about names and why wasn't everyone just speaking Spanish, because everyone understands Spanish. But, you know, I like to communicate, and so I did. I spent a lot of time learning Spanish before I discovered that it wasn't the language here at all. So
I'd like to return just to the story of how a very unique native English speaker ended up becoming deeply ingrained in local Ibizenc society. I wanted to dip into the subject of tribalism, because I feel like today on Ibiza, it's so easy for foreigners to kind of inhabit a certain tribe of people who speak their language. And I wondered, and
it's comfortable.
It's comfortable, and those tribes are so kind of deeply set and ingrained nowadays. And I wondered, in the days when you had arrived on the island and you were learning Catalan, were there other English people around you that you could just spend your time with?
Well, when I first came, I mostly spent my time with other English people. You know, my Spanish was minimal. So when I got involved in Amigos de la Tierra, which was about, I suppose, 10 years later, that's when I started to learn Spanish, and when I discovered that Catalan existed or Ibizenco existed. So at that point, yeah, I'm afraid once I started moving into the Ibizenco culture and doing more things with people, with friends, Ibizenco friends, I didn't want to be with those English people anymore. Partly they left the island. I mean, many of the original friends I had here have left the island or have died or whatever, leaving sometimes because they couldn't afford to live here, which is still happening, of course. There used to be bars where English people would meet and you would meet other people, but no, I don't think, and I have almost no contact with English people now. I've moved away from it totally because I just can't identify with their values at all.
Do you feel that some kind of shift has taken place within you and that you're not the same person that arrived?
Oh, for sure. I've changed, yeah.
Because it goes back to that idea that language, when you learn another language, you do somehow become something.
Yes, exactly. New. There's a lot of studies done by that. My ex-husband actually was one of his, he wrote books on it, and how your language affects your thinking, and your thinking affects your language. So if you have many languages, you have concepts and emotions that you couldn't have if you didn't have those languages. Our example is the word simpático in Spanish is like in English. There's nothing quite like it. It's not nice. It's something else. And once you know that word and that what feeling goes with it, you need it. If you have to speak, English, you need that word. You can't do without it anymore because it's changed you.
I'm so fascinated by this subject. It's something about what lies beneath the words, the feelings that are transmitted.
Mm. Maybe it's also like a music. If you become a musician, I'm sure you have a different feeling towards the whole world and everything in it, because music transforms your inner self in a way too.
I'm really hopeful about the linguistic division on Abhitha, because I feel like over the last, even the last 10 years since I started making this podcast, I feel like more and more people are passionately interested in Abhithan culture, as in foreigners like me. They don't really know how to reach it and how to access it. And I think that a lot of people, including me up until a couple of years ago, it wouldn't have ever occurred to me that it would be actually possible for someone like me to learn Catalan and to actually integrate into that culture. I think there's a feeling of distance and a feeling of, oh, that's an inaccessible world.
Well, because perhaps English don't learn languages at school very much, do they? It's not part of your culture to learn, and it used to be when I was at school, French and Latin and Greek and everything, useless languages as well as useful ones, but it's not part of the culture that's perhaps happens in schools in the last 20 years or 30 years. I've often thought that there's a lot of resources also in the English or foreign community that somehow could be bringing value, bringing something into the culture, everybody's culture. And that's a connection that people can take to, and it can really enrich the local culture, because I think learning Ibithenko, you can give back to the local culture much more than if you didn't. And that's a wonderful thing. I mean, all the town halls now offer Catalan classes. They're cheap or free, I think.
I think it's €30 for 80 hours of Catalan, which is pretty incredible.
Yes, I mean, they all offer these services, and you get together with other people who are as ignorant as you, and that helps because you're not the only one, no?
Yeah.
And that's the way to start. And then you have to bury your pride a little bit and start talking and know you sounding a little bit like a child learning to speak, which you are. Actually.
Absolutely. You have to accept that you can only say 10% of what you actually want to say.
Yes.
For the foreseeable future, yes. Until you improve.
And you have to do it with people who want to speak. I mean, in the local market, there were local people who were happy to speak to me in Ibithenko as well. You have to find the people who will talk back to you always as you want, or even correct them if they don't. And it's great because it does open doors. You see new things you never knew of before in the world around you, in the culture, in the wildlife, in everything. It makes your world bigger.
And how would you say it affects your relationship with the people of this island?
Well, they love it. I mean, that you appreciate their language, they love it. And they're so generous. The Ibithenkos are generous-hearted people. And so you're giving them a little present. I mean, they've made this island as it is. They've done it. They've created it. We're enjoying it. So we can give them something back by speaking their language. And even if it's a few words at the beginning, even helping. I mean, if you have your Ibithenko neighbours and you see they're doing something, and maybe they're elderly and you can offer to help. And there's ways to break down barriers. Well, there aren't really any barriers there, but, you know, they're in our head, aren't they?
Yeah, there's been maybe two or three times when an Ibithenko person has seen me trying to speak Catalan, or I've written them an email in Catalan, knowing that they would appreciate it. And they've replied to me with such kind of wholehearted gratitude and said, thank you so much. I just want to say thank you so much for making the effort to learn our language. It means so much to me.
Yes, yes it does. So, the Ibithenkos of all colours, all political colours, do appreciate it. I say, yeah, do it. And I mean, I had Ibithenko neighbours all around me when I had built this house, And I used to help them get the potatoes and the algarobas and the almonds as well. It was that was a way. I didn't learn much Ibithenko then, that's for sure. Actually, it was before I started, but I was trying to integrate in my way by giving back. And then what happened was, of course, that then they started giving me stuff, and I more or less had to go and help them. And I realized it was an interchange that Ibetengos have always done. With your neighbours, you involve them in something, you give them something, then they help you back. And that's how it all knits together.
And like you said earlier, the Ibetengo language is part of all of that. There are certain words which kind of go with those situations.
Definitely.
And it wouldn't work in another language.
No, it wouldn't. I mean, in the food culture and the special bowls for making bread in, and it all has, they all have different names, and making a stone wall, there's the word for how you do it. In Mallorca, it's different. They make the stone walls differently also. So there's words for the kind of rocks that you're using. There's word for the kind of tools you need to use. And yeah. And as you begin to realise that and see how things function and fit together, it's a lovely thing. It's the jigsaw puzzle that's being solved in front of your eyes. It's a delicious thing.
Well, yeah. Hazel, I know that we've spoken for a long time, but I would love to sort of hear you speaking in the language that I'm most used to hearing you speak.
Oh, I can't. I don't know if I can jump to it with you, can I?
Sí, parlem una mica
de catalán.
Sí, per favor.
Oh, a veure, ask me something.
Què pots dir per acabar aquesta conversació?
A veure, avui la meva família torna. Torna, estan en Granada de vacances i passen superbé visitant castells i tot tipus de coses que no es pot veure aquí. Estan en la glòria, i avui tornaran.
Ai, que bé. M'agradaria anar a Granada ara mateix, m'encanta.
Yes. Sí.
Bé, moltíssimes gràcies, Hazel, i molta sort amb la teva feina tan important, i espero que podem seguir parlant i fent més coses.
Més coses, pues moltes gràcies, Joana.
Gràcies a tu. Una abraçada.
So, back at the Font d'Embrats, the cicada chorus continues in the treetops above my head. I'm still comfortably in the shadow of some trees, whilst the sun bakes nearby me and the sun's rays pour into the mouth of the well of the Font d'Embrats. And I guess that the conclusion that's forming in my head about this subject of llengua, language, is pretty simple. As both of my interviewees have said in their own words, language is territory. One can't be separated from the other. When we deeply encounter a language, we get to know better and more deeply the landscapes which have always been a backdrop to that language. The terrain where it has always been spoken. A while ago, I came across a beautiful essay by the Irish writer Manchan Magan called 32 Words for Field. In it, the late author remembered his grandmother, the person responsible for teaching him Irish Gaelic as a young English speaker. He says, "Perhaps it was then that I first noticed that the two languages I spoke, English and Irish, required not just different forms of grammar and syntax, but different ways of interpreting reality. In Irish Gaelic, there were 5 different words to describe the 5 different stages of sunrise, as observed by the Irish people over many centuries." The writer reflects, there are well over 32 different words for field in Irish. These patches of land may all look the same, and in English, each would probably just be referred to as a field. Yet to someone whose ancestors have been cultivating the ground, growing grain and tending cattle for over 4,000 years, and who has built up the soil over centuries by hauling seaweed from the shore and burning limestone to add alkalinity, they look very different. A couple of examples of these 32 words for field offered by the author are, excuse my pronunciation, Giamar, a field of corn grass. Biorash, a marshy field. Banog, a field levelled out by years of dancing. As we near the end of this rambling podcast episode, I think there's only one thing left to do, and that's to dip into some traditional refrains from the Ivesenk language, the language linked to these landscapes. These expressions reveal a universe of local knowledge linking the Ibithan pageses, the peasants, to the landscapes, the shifting seasons, the elements, and of course, the ocean around this little island. Here we go. Agua de abril, cada gota va per mil. The April rains are wonderful for the crops. And de figas flores, and de plores. A lot of fig blossoms means that there'll be a very poor fig harvest. Boira pastura, agua segura. Low fog is a sign that rain is on its way. De ponent noi corre torrent, y si corre, corre violent. When the ponent wind blows, the stream won't flow, but if it does, expect it to flow violently. Luna ajaguda mariner despert. Low-lying moon, fisherman awake. Or in other words, a low or new moon is the perfect time for going fishing. So I'm stepping once more down the stone steps into the chamber of the Font den Prats. And I'm staring once again at these faint traces of red lines, geometric lines and motifs that are remaining on the plaster on the sides of the tunnel. So you might remember that I was going to tell you something about one person who did have a theory about the meaning of these decorations. And you might not be very surprised when you hear who it is. His name was Rolf Blakstad. Norwegian anthropologist, historian, architect, poetical soul. Rolf was an outsider to the island for sure, but with a heart full of inquisitiveness, awe and wonder regarding the ancient mysteries of Ibiza. So back in the late 1950s, Rolf visited this well, as well as many others, and did a series of exquisite drawings of what he found within them. And on his encounter with the Font den Prats, Rolf painted what he saw of the decorations remaining on the walls of the chamber. It was a clear, vivid, geometric design of lines painted in red manganese oxide, leading towards a single point at the base of the well chamber, above the water. In his seminal book, La Casa Ibicenca, Rolf interpreted this mysterious set of paintings as the rays of the sun entering the well chamber to meet the subterranean uterus of Mother Earth, the goddess. So, a couple of months ago, on a Catalan language hike to this well, I finally had the chance to show these drawings and share this theory with a group of local Ibithans and to hear their thoughts on Blakstad's idea. Oh, he had some funny ideas, did that Blakstad, was one reply. I don't think there's anything mystical or spiritual about these decorations. Usually the everyday normal explanation is the right one. When I heard these responses on excitedly sharing them with some of these people, I let them wash over me for a moment, suddenly seeing in a flash these two different camps of people. Ibiza's English-speaking outsiders with their romantic, esoteric ideas. And then on the other side, Ibiza's native people with their no-nonsense practicality. And I saw the impossible crevasse between the two and I wondered whether they would ever meet in the middle. And then suddenly, a younger Ibizan woman came up to me and said very quietly, "Yeah, but I think what we've forgotten is that back then in those days, in normal everyday life, water was always seen as spiritual. Water is life." And in a second, she was gone. And with that, the hiking party continued their route through the woods.
Per aquesta situació de fer molt de fred, es ven, s'aboia.
You've been listening to The Wells of Tanit, created by me, Joanna Ruby. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please help to spread the word and leave us a review on iTunes, as this really helps the podcast reach more listeners. The theme music is the song De Joet Vas Despedient by the Ibethan folk group Uk, released by Producciones Blau.
No l'he trasmudat de res dels tractus que els dos teníem. Jo seguiré el mateix, visquent amb molta alegria. I a conhortat després de lo que mos pervendria, i en sé que no et sé ni et veig, que això et content algun dia. Per això no t'abandon i has de pensar que t'oblidi, que dins mon cor repeteix lo que em deies aquell dia. Sempre t'apreciaré i on se fuia que sigues, només per dar-te entenent que de tu estic content.